I've been playing with the Gospel of Mark since about May of 1984, that it's been sort of an interest of mine, and I've been using this book. It's called Mark as Story, by David Rhodes and Donald Mitchie. David is a New Testament scholar, and Donald is a English lit person at Carthage College in Wisconsin, Kenosha, Wisconsin. Unfortunately, I invited David to come out and do the same thing, and now I feel chintzy about the whole business. He's so good at this thing, I feel like. There might be somebody in the room that's heard it from David, and then I don't feel so great. What David does is recite the Gospel of Mark from memory. So I'm not going to do that, but I'm going to read. I'm going to read the Gospel of Mark to you this week. So one way or another, if you come to the sessions, you're going to get the Gospel of Mark. And then we'll talk about it, because David and Donald treat it as a story. And rather than say any more about it, I'm going to read the Gospel of Mark. I'll be using the translation that Rhodes and Ritchie used in this book. The book's in the library, and I think it's also in the bookstore. The translation is their own translation, and it's important also because they're very careful to use certain words that they think are important. For instance, you'll hear this morning when Jesus is baptized, the heavens are ripped open. And the verb ripped open is the same verb used when he dies. And the temple is, the curtain is ripped open. So to keep that, there are a lot of the connections in here that you'll pick up. But I don't have to say any more about it, all right? The beginning of the good news about Jesus, the Anointed One, the Son of God, just as it is written in Isaiah the prophet, "Look, I am sending my messenger ahead of you who will pave your way, a cry of one shouting in the desert, prepare the Lord's way, make the paths level." It was John baptizing in the desert and proclaiming a baptism of repentance for the pardon of sins. And the whole Judean countryside and all the Jerusalemites were going out to him and being baptized of him in the Jordan River, acknowledging their sins. John was wearing camel's hair with a leather band around his waist and was eating grasshoppers and wild honey. And he was proclaiming, saying, "After me is coming one stronger than I, the strap of whose sandals I am not worthy to stoop and untie. I baptized you with water, but he will baptize you in the Holy Spirit." And it happened in those days that Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized by John in the river Jordan. And immediately coming out from the water, he saw the heavens being ripped open and the Spirit like a dove coming down upon him. And there was a voice from the heavens, "You are my only Son, in you I took delight." And immediately the Spirit sent him out into the desert. And he was in the desert 40 days being tested by Satan. And he was among the wild animals. And angels came and served him. Now after that, John was handed over. And Jesus came into Galilee proclaiming the good news about God and saying, "The right time is fulfilled. And the rule of God has come near. Repent and put faith in the good news." And passing along the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, the brother of Simon, casting nets in the sea, for they were fishermen. And Jesus said to them, "Come after me, and I will make you fishers of men." And immediately leaving their nets, they followed him. Going ahead a little further, he saw James, sons of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who were in the boat preparing nets. And immediately he called them, and leaving their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired hands, they went off after him. they entered into Capernaum. And immediately on the Sabbath, he entered into the synagogue and began teaching. And people were astounded at his teaching. For he was teaching them as one having authority and not like the legal experts. And immediately, a man with an unclean spirit was in their synagogue and screamed out, saying, "What do you have against us, Jesus Nazarene? Did you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." And Jesus rebuked it, saying, "Shut up and come out of here." And the unclean spirit, convulsing the man and crying out with a loud cry, came out from the man. And everyone was so astonished that they were arguing among themselves. "What is this? A new teaching with authority? He gives orders to unclean spirits and they obey him?" And the report about him immediately went out everywhere, into the whole surrounding countryside of Galilee. And immediately coming out from the synagogue, they went with James and John to the house of Simon and Andrew. Now Simon's mother-in-law was lying down with a fever, and immediately they told him about her. Approaching her, he grasped her hand and raised her up. And the fever left her, and she began serving them. Now, when it was evening and the sun had set, people were bringing to him all those who were sick and those possessed by demons. And Simon and those with him tracked him down, and they found and said to him, "The many who were sick want to see you and be healed by you." And Jesus healed those who were sick with diseases and drove out many demons, but he would not let the demons talk because they knew him. And he said to them, "Let's go elsewhere to the nearby town, so I might proclaim there too, for that's why I came out." And he went in proclaiming in their synagogues and on all Galilee and driving out the demons. A leper came to him, pleading with him, falling on his knees and saying to him, "If you want to, you are able to make me clean." And moved by compassion, Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him. Then said to him, "I want to. Be clean." And immediately the leprosy went away from him and he was made clean. And becoming harsh with him, immediately Jesus drove him out and said to him, "See that you say nothing at all to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and make for your cleansing the offering Moses prescribed as testimony to them." But going out, he began to proclaim freely and spread the word around, so that no longer was Jesus able to enter openly into a city, but was outside in the desert places. And people kept coming to him from everywhere. When he entered again into Capernaum after some days, it was reported that he was in his house. And so many people gathered there that there was no longer room, not even places at the door. And he was telling them the word. And people came bringing to him a cripple carried by four of them. And not being able to get into him because of the crowd, they unroofed the roofing where he was. And digging through, they let down the mat so that the cripple was lying, on which the cripple was lying, and seeing their faith, Jesus said to the cripple, "Child, your sins are pardoned." Now some of the legal experts were sitting there and thinking in their minds, "Why does this man talk like this? He blasphemes. Who's able to pardon sins except the one God?" And immediately aware in his spirit that they were thinking like this within themselves, Jesus said to them, "Why are you thinking these things in your minds? Which is easier to say to the cripple, 'Your sins are pardoned,' or to say, 'Rise and take up your mat and walk'? But so you may know that the Son of Man has authority to pardon sins on the earth," he said to the cripple, "I'm telling you, rise, take up your mat, and go off to your house." And he rose And immediately, taking up a mat, he went out in front of everyone, with the result that everyone was stunned. And glorified God, saying, "We never saw anything like this." And he went out again by the sea. And the whole crowd came to him, and he was teaching them, and passing by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting in the toll tax office, and he said to him, "Follow me." And rising, he followed him. And it happened he was reclining to eat in Levi's house, and many toll collectors and sinners were reclining to eat with Jesus and his disciples. And there were many there, and they were following him. And when the legal experts of the Pharisees saw that he was eating with the sinners and the toll collectors, he said to the disciples, "Why is he eating with the toll collectors and sinners?" And hearing it, Jesus said to them, "Those who are healthy have no need for a doctor, but those who are sick do. I came not to call righteous people, but sinners." John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting. And people came and said to him, "Why are the disciples of John, the disciples of the Pharisees, fasting, but your disciples are not fasting?" And Jesus said to him, "Are the attendants of the bridegroom able to fast while the bridegroom is with them? As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they aren't able to fast. But the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in that day. No one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth to an old cloak. Otherwise, the patch pulls away from it, the new from the old, and the rip becomes worse. And no one puts fresh wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the wine will burst the wineskins, and the wine and the skins will be destroyed. Instead, put fresh wine into fresh wineskins." It happened that on the Sabbath he was going through the grain fields, and the disciples began to make their way, picking the heads of the grain as they went. The Pharisees said to them, "Look, why are they doing what is not legal on the Sabbath?" He said to them, "Haven't you ever read what David did when he had a need, he and those with him when they were hungry? How he entered into the house of God when Abiathar was high priest and ate the bread of the presence, which is not legal for anyone to eat except the priests, and he also gave to those who were with him?" And then he said to them, "The Sabbath originated for humanity, not humanity for the Sabbath. And so the Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath." He entered again into a synagogue, and a man was there who had a withered hand. And they were watching him closely, whether on the Sabbath he would heal him, so they might bring charges against him. And he said to the man with the withered hand, "Come here, rise to the center." And then Jesus said to them, "Is it legal on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm? To restore a life or to put to death?" But they kept quiet. And then looking around at them with anger, saddened by the hardening of their hearts, he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And he stretched it out. And the hand was made new. And going out, the Pharisees immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him, how they might destroy him. Jesus withdrew with the disciples again to the sea, and a huge number from Galilee followed, and also from Judea, and from Jerusalem, and from Idumea, and from across the Jordan, and from around Tyre and Sidon. A huge number, hearing what he was doing, came to him. And he told his disciples to keep a little boat for him, waiting for him because of the crowd, so they would not press him. For he healed so many that those having ailments were falling on him just in order to touch him. And the unclean spirits, when they saw him, would fall down before him and scream, saying, "You are the Son of God." And he would rebuke them vehemently, not to make him known. And he went up into a mountain and summoned those whom he wanted, and they went off to him. And he made 12 so they might be with him, and he might send them out to proclaim and to have authority to drive out the demons. And he made the 12, and Simon, he nicknamed Peter, and James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, he nicknamed Boanerges, which means sons of thunder. Also Andrew and Philip and Bartholomew and Matthew and Thomas and James the son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus and Simon the Canaanite and Judas Iscariot, who also handed him over. He came into a house, and such a crowd came together again that they were not even able to eat bread. And when his family heard, they came out to seize him, for they were saying, "He's out of his mind." The legal experts who came down from Jerusalem were saying, "He's possessed by Beelzebub, and by the ruler of demons, he drives out the demons." And summoning them, he began to talk to them in riddles. How is Satan able to drive out Satan? If a rule is divided against itself, the rule is not able to stand. And if a house is divided against itself, the house will not be able to stand. And if Satan did rise up against himself and was divided, he isn't able to stand, but is at an end. On the other hand, surely no one is able to enter into the house of the strong one and plunder his goods unless first he binds the strong one, and then he will plunder his house. I swear to you that everything will be pardoned, the sons of men, their sins and whatever blasphemies they blaspheme, yet whoever blasphemes against the Holy Spirit won't obtain a pardon ever, but is guilty of an eternal sin, because they were saying he had an unclean spirit. His mother and brothers came, and standing outside, they sent someone into him, calling to him, and the crowd was sitting around him, and they said to him, "Look, your mother and your brothers are outside and seeking you." And answering them, he said, "Who are my mother and my brothers?" And looking around at those seated in a circle with him, he said, "Look, here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God, that is my brother and sister and mother." David Rhodes, I'm not, but that's the first part of the story. It's about 27 pages in the book. You can read it in about 40 minutes if you want. Part of the point of this week's study will be to invite you to read it again on yourself, and if you're going to be here in the session, at least you get to hear it, but I think there's advantage also of reading it. The suggestion that David makes, and I too, that you don't follow it in the book at all, just listen and imagine it, and let it go. Do you have reactions to hearing it?
Sure. My reaction always is, how would we respond to Jesus? We respond the same way that the legal experts did, probably. I'm afraid, it frightens me to think that, but mm-hmm. he was obviously nonconformist, not conforming to what the people they thought a religious man should be. It's kind of scary to think about that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah.
What has always struck me about the Gospel of Mark is that it seems to be a story for those of us who do have trouble with the message. We believe Jesus is our Savior. And yet, the start of the Gospel has everyone coming out of the town, going into the desert, crowds of people following Jesus. But the more he says, the fewer follow. Until the very end, he is left alone. And I think it's a message for our time when we are stuck in a tradition that says what seemed to work for a previous time, a different mental understanding, and yet there are new things to learn from Jesus' message, and we have to have our ears open for his message to apply to our problems today.
Thank you. Yes.
A new thing that struck me is comes from that translation, but you were mentioning the heavens ripped mm-hmm. open and the curtain of the temple being ripped open mm-hmm. and the connection where Jesus says, you don't put a new cloth on an old garment or the rip is made worse. And mm-hmm. it's like, I was thinking about that since you read it, I guess. Like the old view of the universe, mm-hmm. our limits are ripped open, and mm-hmm. the old religion is ripped open. The old wineskins are ripped open, and the new is coming.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah. And back first, then here. Yes.
I was just going to say, regarding your comment, the more and more Jesus says, the fewer and fewer followers he has. And I really agree with that. But what I appreciate about the Mark text is that it's not so much, for me, what Jesus was saying, but what he was doing. And the more and more he does, and more actions he takes, to me seem like the reasons why people follow him less. Mm-hmm. Not only what he says, but what he does.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, please.
I observed last night during Eucharist that we are traditionalists. And we were waiting for someone to give us directions how we were to do it, and because it was done in a different way, we were a little confused. And that same thing happened, I think, in our whole religious life, that we like to be told what to do, and we like to follow orders, and we don't have very much freedom. We don't use our freedom in our mm-hmm. expression of religion or in how we share our religion with others. Mm-hmm. We are like the people in Jesus' day, where if it was different, it was must be wrong.
Mm-hmm. How many times the story said they were astounded and they were stunned? Yeah. How long have you been? How long since you've been astounded or stunned at church? Yeah.
I was struck by how the story needs to be told aloud. A couple of summers ago in Edmonton, there's a summer theater festival every summer, and it's done outside on the hillside over the river valley. And one of the university drama profs did a one-person rendition of the Gospel of Mark. And it just took hold of the theater festival, and more people came to hear this guy tell the story of Mark, and the theater critics and the papers were astounded and stunned that such a piece would be the hit of the festival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fellow traveled the country. I heard him about 8 years ago in Chicago, Michigan Boulevard in Chicago, filled theater, ran for weeks, just stood up there and recited the Gospel of Mark. Charles, somebody pointed out in the early session, Charles Laughton used to do it in King James translation way back. So as you say, the story is told. Reveal a little part of a little bit of my bias is that I have a feeling, and this might be as cynical as well as critical, that Lutherans especially have a terrible eagerness to get into the epistles. And I think neglect often the gospel. The gospels, but also the gospel. My feeling is when the epistles were read, it's probably true that somebody had just finished telling the story. And then the epistles made sense. Because it was all in response to that story that they were acting. And I suspect, Barbara I think was saying some of that last night in her proclamation, that you get moving around with the epistles by themselves, you might easily be pushed aside a little bit from what the story is about, that you can get excited and be stunned by. Certainly there's gospel in the epistles as well. But that goes back to my early training too. First of all, I remember in confirmation class after spending 400 years in a parochial school, we started in September for confirmation and went from September till March studying the Ten Commandments. Then about 2.5 weeks, we covered prayer, baptism, the Lord's Supper, the whole bit. My first year in parish ministry, I had one of the classic failures of my life. I've been working at others since, but a classic one. Three children, two young women and a young man. Young man ended up in federal prison about 2.5 years. Both of the girls were pregnant by age 14, outside of wedlock, and that's when I decided to go into youth ministry. The only place I could go is up. But what I did from then on is that we spent the first 2.5 to 3 months studying the gospel so that the kids could write and tell their own story of the gospel. And then, it seemed to me, the rest of the stuff made a lot more sense. And I think we all ought to be able to tell the story, you know, in our own way. I don't mean in any kind of special sequence. The writers of the gospel, they move stuff around all the time. You know, each of them had their purpose. And this story that maybe happened here in one gospel made more sense over here. And the point wasn't the sequence. The point was what was happening. What was Jesus, as Sarah said, not only saying, but doing. And how did all this fit together, and how does that impact? Yes.
When you were telling the story, and I sort of heard you telling it rather than just reading it, mm-hmm. it reminded me that that's the way the early Christians heard it. Mm-hmm. And we are so used to our King James and our Phillips and our Revised Standard and so on, that we forget that in the beginning it was just the oral mm-hmm. tradition of telling mm-hmm. the story, and how much more mm-hmm. down-to-earth that is and real it becomes. Mm-hmm.
And we get terribly accustomed to the snippets, you know, that we do in the lessons, clip a little piece out. Or in our Sunday school, this is even worse, you know, how we snip out the parts that we don't want the kids to hear. Like, what's the ending of the story of the book of the story of Daniel in the lion's den? Clergy exempted. What's the ending? Well, I don't want to embarrass the clergy, they may not know. Excuse me. What's the ending of the story? Daniel and the lion's den. Who knows?
People get thrown in the lions.
Pardon?
People get thrown
in
the lions.
Oh, yeah. That's the part we cut out. Daniel gets out. The people who put him in get thrown in, get chewed up.
Yeah.
Sure. But we throw it away. not saying what we should do with that, but we're used to snippets and we're used to edited versions. There is advantage at times just having the whole thing happen and hear how it is built. The book, Mark as Story, came about when Rhodes, who is the New Testament scholar, asked Ritchie, who is a literature prof, to say, how would you talk to my class about the story of Mark's gospel? Oh, he said, that's easy. And then he started outlining what he would do. And then Rhodes said, well, why don't you come in and do it? And it turned the kids on so much that what they did is talk, first of all, about the rhetoric. How is the story told? How is it put together? And then they talked about the settings in which the story is all placed. Then they looked at the plot. What's the plot going on? You began getting a feel, I would hope, of the plot as you were listening before. And then the characters. And then the last chapter is a guess at what happened to the people then when they heard it the first time. And of course the students just flocked to the class and it ended up in the book. I understand they're talking together now about the Gospel of Matthew as well.
Keith Miller has done some tapes on the Gospel of Matthew that we studied prior
to, which
were a lot of fun. He told it as a story.
Yeah, good. No, and there's levels of it. There's this upfront story of Jesus moving here, and then the whole business of how the rule of God is coming into action in that place. And there's this sort of sparring between the two stories as you hear them going on, and the enemies are the counterpoint between not only Jesus and the disciples, which is pretty clear in many places in there, but Jesus and the opposition, the legal experts, or Jesus and the demons, Jesus and the creation, the stuff that's going on. You have all of those things. And a lot of people say that Mark really is a very brief story of the passion of Christ, the suffering and death, with a terribly long introduction. He's got 16 chapters. The last couple chapters are what it's all about. And he spends 14 chapters getting there so that you might hear the story. Rhodes and Ritchie point out it's important to ask who's telling the story. It's not Jesus telling it. It's not one of the characters in the plot telling the story. It's an observer on the outside telling the story. And what kind of an observer? First of all, a terribly biased observer. Pro-Jesus all the way. Can you imagine reading the gospel written by a Pharisee's disciple or something? You get a whole different story if you get a pro legal expert telling the same events, but terribly biased in the direction of Jesus. And you have a storyteller who is telling the story that is omniscient, knows everything, knows even what people in the story are thinking, tells you what they're thinking. The people in the event don't know what they're thinking, but you do. Not only does Jesus see what they're thinking in their hearts, but you know that Jesus sees it. You get the inside track. So he clues you from the beginning that he wants you some way, somehow, to be on Jesus' side. That's the background of the rhetoric that is used in the story. And then uses all kinds of devices in the story. The riddles that are used selectively and put together. The counterpoint of the various stories, the repeating of rejection and picking up again. The story goes up to about the middle of the eighth chapter, And then Peter says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And then it moves down towards Jerusalem. It actually makes a circle if you look on the map. They're up there, and then they go back down. And the story gets tighter and tighter. Well, in one sense, it's really fast moving. You caught the word immediately. And immediately they went in here. And immediately somebody came. And immediately, and immediately, immediately. And then the storyteller slows the story down when they head down. He begins to pace it. It's tighter in the sense of more focus. They aren't here, here, and here. But it's paced. Slower. 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 And then the crucifixion. And as I said, the number of devices in the rhetoric that are used, he uses the very terse and concrete language. It clicks, it hits, it moves fast. Uses repetition. You begin hearing some of the phrases that kept coming back. Uses the two-step thing. We read one of those was pretty obviously. Now when it was evening, after the sun had set. He'll do that again and again and again. And it's always the second one that's more important. The evening is, you've got enough of a thing there. It's evening, you can get a picture of that. But when the sun was set, he wanted you to know the sun was gone down by that time. The second one always is the punch, and that is repeated again and again in here as a part of the style. Lots of questions. Jesus asks the disciples ask Jesus. The opponents ask Jesus, they're back and forth, it's loaded with questions. It's concentric, it moves around in this way, it doesn't logically go ba-dong, 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 and then end here, it just moves around in circles. It just tends to be, you know, not much to our liking to be done that way. There's lots of series of threes that are done, or quotations, and there's lots of irony in it. Lots of irony, where things are expected to be a certain way and they just don't go that way. Or odd things are put together. And what we like to call oxymorons here, you know, like jumbo shrimp is an oxymoron. Or military intelligence. Yeah. Or as the people in the village say, Elmer Witt. And then the final irony, of course, is down in Jerusalem, that in the center, the place that is the focal point, both of revelation as well as of the worship of God, that's there where they decide to kill God. And the irony is they think they've won.
The TV drama, Jesus of Nazareth, I've never seen it before, and I tend to shy away from this piece, because I always think it's probably going to be, you know, I don't know how many of you saw that, but I just happened to turn my TV on at 10 o'clock and caught bits of it, and it began to really catch me up. Mm-hmm. I thought it was, by and large, pretty exciting, you know, thing. Pretty well done. But at the very end, when, I don't know if it was Ananias or one of the principal characters, walks into the temple and says, it's just begun now.
Yeah.
It's just beginning. It's terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought that was very well presented.
I've not seen that.
Oh, it would be worth trying to get it. It has its Hollywoodisms, you know. It has its sensational sort of dumb, theatrical, but it's really powerful. I don't know, what's the reaction? Did anyone else see that?
Yeah, I did.
We used it in Tucson with our students during Easter 1 year, saw the whole, what is it, 9 hours?
Mm-hmm.
8 hours.
So.
And had good discussion. Like you said, there are aspects to it. You know, Jesus is a very stereotypical Jesus, right? Thin and you know, blue eyes and the whole nine yards, but not very Jewish looking.
No.
But aside from that, it's well acted, and there's something about it, I think, as you say, of the telling of the story, even with some distortions and some things that can't help but be kind of moving because it's visual before you.
And the whole conflict with the priests and the elders and Jesus is very well brought out. And the people just say, we can't have this man doing this. We can't allow this. I mean, you can just see it happening in our hierarchy. Mm-hmm. We can't let this guy go around and throw the temple, you know, crash the tables and the money changers in the temple. Mm-hmm. We just can't allow this sort of thing. It's good. But like I said, at the end when he says, this is just the beginning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Powerful.
There's really a contrast between seeing this Jesus of Nazareth movie and hearing the story told such as you did this morning, and then the way we hear it in our churches on Sunday, mm-hmm. there's a contrast to those, and that's why we're struck by hearing the story on mm-hmm. one piece, or seeing Jesus of Nazareth. There must be something there about the readers in our church services. Mm-hmm. Some of them are very good at giving the feelings of the gospel, and others just read it. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference here of how people respond. Or is it 80% of all the things that we communicate are by our actions and by our tone,
for sure,
but not by the words? Sometimes all we get is just the words. Mm-hmm.
Yes?
The contrast and irony that you were talking about that's in the Gospel of Mark hit me a couple years ago, double barrel. It occurred to me that when I was growing up, I had the Jewish people and the legal experts, I like that translation, cast in the role of the bad guys. And mm-hmm. then Jesus comes along, and once for all, we have new wineskins and new mm-hmm. ideas, and they're handed on to us, and we're good, and we're holy, and we've got it mm-hmm. all together. And it started to dawn on me that these were God's people. And that they started out with a simple message of be family to one another. I mean, the Exodus event is all about that. And yet they wanted to be comfortable and to be sure. And so they add this little code and this little code and this little code until they've got the thing so locked in that their religious experience is really more in terms of the legal experts than it is in terms of their relationship to each other. And darned if we Christians haven't done the same thing again and again. I mean, that was one of the most thrilling things a couple of years ago when I suddenly realized the mentality of Martin Luther in his moment in history, that it hit him that there had to be a new wineskin to enclose, to hold mm-hmm. this gospel message, and that he had to tell it in new words and cut through all the legal experts that were around. And now, right now, I think, is a real age of the Spirit, with a few people becoming aware that we need new wineskins all over again, because we're beginning to become very stodgy and very comfortable and very legal in our religion. For us, our church experience has become more like legal expertise than it was like community of faith and serving, and we've kind of crashed through that, stepped out of that, and tried to live what's in the gospel.
If, as many of the scholars, I think most of the scholars say, the Gospel of Mark ends early, you know, the last part is viewed as being added later on. The ending that is normally accepted today is the one that ends up with the women at the tomb. And messenger says, go give this message to the disciples of Peter. He's going on before you into Galilee. There you will see him as he told you. And then they went out and ran away from the tomb, beside themselves with terror. They said nothing to anybody, for they were afraid. and then stop. Nothing more. No resurrection stuff, no nice ending and everything else. The point of the story being, seems to be, will anybody go to Galilee? And a pretty good deduction from Mark's telling the story. Just now we, again, Rhodes and Ritchie say, stick with Mark for a while. Just stay with Mark. Others are very important too, but for a while, just get Mark's message. And Mark's message seems to be, nobody's going to show. Or the more important question, would you have gone? Or the even more important question, will you go? Will you meet Jesus in the Galilees of your life? So the telling of the story is so much more than simply, you know, isn't it nice to know that Jesus was there, da-da-da-da, or Jesus did this or said that. That's much more, much more. Where are you? You got the guts, translate faith. You have the faith to meet him in Galilee and go on. Or as they said, it's only the beginning. Mark does, I think, a very strong job of that. It's not only brief, it's not only pointed, but it sort of lets it all hang out. As you say, well, is anybody going to really believe anymore? Somebody else. Yes?
I just wanted to feedback on the thing of your readings in church. So we mentioned Charles Lawton before, and in terms of the storytelling, he's fascinated me. He said something about Bible stories are the easiest to tell because they were told before they were written. Mm-hmm. And he says that in telling them or anything, I knew that the easiest part would be to memorize it. And then from there on, learn to really communicate it. Mm-hmm. Part of the trouble with reading in church that I see is that people walk up and read it. They haven't even seen it before, except last year, or 3 years ago. But I think that's important to really get into it, to know it, to be able to tell it while you're reading. And he says, because it was told before it was written, there are places to go loud and places to go soft, and a good actor will probably go... Sure.
Father's Day gift yesterday, a book from my daughter. Some of you saw me on the boat, I was reading it. The title is Women, Fire, and Dangerous Things. The interesting thing is that that's a category. It's a study of categories. Because if you decide what your categories are, you probably decided a lot about how you're going to think about things in life. And that happens to be a category, one category, of a small tribe in Australia that they put fire, women, and dangerous things into a category. Not because women are fire or dangerous things, but because that, for them, is a category that makes sense. And the book is about, you know, how we got our categories and where we come from. Most of our categories were extraneous to us. They exist up here as if something is out there. And then you check it, you check your experience against this category out here and decide whether it's good or not or bad or not or valuable or not. And the new understanding of categories, and whenever you say new, it might be the last 1,400 years or the last 40 minutes, whatever it may be, has to do much more, and I think this is what you were getting at, has to do with your own experience and particularly even your own body. So that that kind of reality, so your conviction about what is real has to do with the kind of a category that you assume, whether it is static, distant, external, or whether it is dynamic and immediate, and has to do not only with an understanding or a hearing or even a judgment, but it has to do with movement yourself, the action. If you just, it's an old story, if you take the first book of Genesis, the first chapter of the book of Genesis, and just go through and mark the verbs. They bounce off of the page. The whole business is action. Moves like that. And when we get the feel and the touch, especially of the characters that are involved in this story, and especially the main character, Jesus, you get to get the feel and sense the flesh and the blood and the feelings and all the rest of stuff, then I think that's, you know, part of the aliveness. And then that stuck-in category that things that don't appear possible are happening all the time. The possibility of the impossible is one of the faith categories. And how to put that together. Because it doesn't sound possible to us, how often we're ready to throw it out, or at least not absorb it. You know, it's something I will tuck away back here, but I'm not going to do anything about that. And I think maybe that's why we're not stunned and astounded very often. Because we have, our categories don't, it doesn't fit our categories, then we push it aside. We've got nice ways of handling that. So I'll be reading about fire, women, and dangerous things this week. So anyone else? We'll talk about the geography tomorrow, and we'll be reading the gospel. And they'll talk about the physical settings for what's happening in Mark's version. We'll be talking about the plot on Wednesday. We're going to be talking about the characters, the variety of characters that are in on Thursday. And then we'll do some evaluating of, you know, what we think that stuff was all about when it hit then and what it is about for us now. And my encouragement to you is to read it again. Pick up one of the translations if you want to get the book in the bookstore or in the library and read their translation. I think it's a neat one. It's not bothered with all those little marks of verses and chapters and all that stuff that we're stuck in. And you just sit down and read it. As I said before, I think it takes about 40 minutes to read their translation, depending on how fast you read. But it'd be sort of nice to be able to go away from home and say, well, you know what I did? I read the Gospel of Mark 3 times 1 week. Might be fun. Thanks very much.
Thank you.